right, welcome to the Mudgel Slate Show. That's Decisions from Outer National. That's right. And there's a whole lot of decisions in the world today that we got to be making, that people got to be paying attention to. And this show is going to reflect that today, as it does always anyway. At the back end of the show, Michelle Chai of Refused Fascism Los Angeles will be joining us to talk about a new trip to the border to raise a banner in the sky. And it's a 25-foot banner in the sky, and it's in different languages, and it's holding a 150-foot banner on the ground, which reads, "To the world's migrants and all humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America." So stay tuned for that. And as sometimes happens on the Michael Slate Show, we spoke with Michelle before the action she talked about, the banner in the sky. But I think you'll want to hear what she has to say about the border, the wall, and the stand we all have to take when confronted by a fascist regime. Before that, we'll be talking with Carl Dix, a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And Carl will be talking about Nicholas Hayward Sr., who was a tireless fighter for justice. And people all over the country knew Nicholas because of the work that he was doing. And Nicholas died on December 31st. And Carl will be talking about him. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be bringing this segment to you. You know, most of you, if you're alive, if you're breathing in L.A., you know now, you know, you got to know about what's happening with the school system and the teachers going on strike. And, you know, it's sort of it's a major question. And people really need to pay attention to this because there's so much more concentrated up in it than just a union strike or a work battle or something like that. There's a lot of different things concentrated in this. And I'm really pleased to be bringing to the show today Glenn Sachs. Glenn teaches high school social studies in LAUSD. And he was recently recognized by Deputy Superintendent Vivian Akchian for exceptional levels of performance as evidenced by an overall final evaluation rating of exceed standards. And he's also somebody who's not afraid to talk out and talk back about what is going on and why people need to pay attention to this strike and what's so important about it. Glenn, welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be here.
Great. Let's jump into this because I have a ton of questions for you, man, and we'll have to get ready for them, all right? So why are teachers ready to go on strike right now? What are some of the key demands of the strike? People don't really know that much about it, I think.
Well, I agree with you. People don't know enough about it. You know, I think everybody's kind of waking up to it here in L.A. now, and, you know, there's a certain amount of reaction of, oh, my God, you're going on strike. Why are you doing this? You know, we've been negotiating for 21 months. This has been going on for a long, long time. And, you know, in all that time, the district has offered us almost nothing. So finally, we're in a position where, you know, we just have to go ahead and do this unless there's some last-minute initiative from the district. You know, most of this is not about money for us, raises for us. We're pretty close on money with the district. That's not the main issue. The main issue is forcing the district to invest in our students. Have a nurse in each school, have a librarian in each school. We're trying to bring the student-to-counselor ratio down to 500 to 1. It should be 250 to 1. We're trying to bring it down to 500 to 1. And then the number one issue is class sizes. The class sizes are simply too big, and we're trying to get the district to invest the money to lower the class size. I mean, just for example, just at my school here, you know, we have a lot of classes over 40, 45. We have an AP U.S. government class with 52 kids in it. We have four AP English classes taught by one teacher that have all four of them have over 40 students in it. You know, we're supposed to be teaching the kids writing, working with them on their writing and working with them individually. There's just no way you could do that effectively with that amount of students. So there's a bunch of issues, but the number one issue is class size.
Well, let's dig a little deeper into this. How does this impact education, this class size thing? Because I agree, this is an extremely important, basically a demand, but an extremely important development in relation to the education of children. This is something that I want to explore it a little bit more.
Different teachers at different levels have different perspective. I'm a high school teacher. You know, to me, a big part of the problem with class sizes, obviously the larger the class is, the larger it is to keep everybody on focus and everybody under control or whatever, but that's not really the issue. You know, there's a lot of things about this profession that a lot of the general public doesn't seem to be aware of, and the district kind of mulishly pretends that they're not aware of. It's a big, big difference on a Saturday whether I've got 120 essays to grade or 195. That's a big difference. There's a tremendous amount of work we do outside the classroom. The classroom's just part of it. You know, I always say when the school bell rings at 3:02, my day's not over. My first shift is over. And then I come home and I have a second shift of work. And a big part of that is grading papers, is reading essays, is giving suggestions and things, essays. So, you know, all that stuff has a big impact, and I feel like the district just kind of ignores it. It's almost like, you know, people believe an actor or actress, you know, the only time that they're working is when they're on screen or on stage, you know, ignoring all the other things, the preparation, all the other things that go into it.
Mm-hmm. Now, why has the LAUSD been able to ignore what the contract that the teachers, what that actually says about the limits on class size, the importance of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's another issue here. You know, it's like we're being, you know, some people think we're being radical or something. We're just trying to get, a lot of this, we're just trying to get LAUSD to obey their own contract, the contract they signed. What happens is this. We have something in the contract called Section 1.5, and that says if there's an emergency, the district can violate, can deviate from the class size averages and the class size caps. They can lay people off. They can have larger class sizes. And, you know, this was something probably originally it was a legitimate thing for an emergency. Instead, every year for the last 10 years, the district has claimed they have an emergency, and they've used it to lay off teachers. They've used it to raise class sizes and to violate the contract. And we just want Section 1.5 gone. We want them, I know it's a radical idea, we want them to obey the class size averages and the class size caps that are in the contract. That's what we want, and that's one of our biggest demands.
Mm-hmm. And for people to understand this, again, try and drive that home to people. What's the importance of that demand? What's the importance of that in terms of you guys, but also in terms of the students themselves?
Well, I think it has a big impact. I mean, look, there's only so much of us to go around. I mean, during the school year, I work 70 hours a week. I can't remember the last time during a school year that I did not work both a Saturday and a Sunday. We work very hard, but however hard we work, there's only so much of us to go around. And you know, the more students you have, the less individual attention you're able to give them, the less you're able to make an exception here or an exception there, the less you're able to pick up on this student's problem and that or that student's problem and help them. I mean, you just see it all over the place, all over the place. And it makes us less effective. And I don't like that. As professionals, we don't like that. Mm-hmm. And it makes it worse for the students, and we're not able to do all for the students that we would like to do. And, you know, Austin Buettner, the superintendent, he has, to his credit, he has made an issue of attendance, trying to improve attendance. And, you know, that's a complicated issue. There's a lot of different aspects of it. You know, there are kids in LAUSD at my school, for example, you know, their families are really struggling to get by. And you know, we have kids that are coming in late to school because they're working till 10, 11 o'clock at night because they're trying to help their parents pay the rent. So there's a lot of different aspects of it, but I can't help but believe that a kid's a lot more likely to come to school if he's in a class with 24 other kids and the teacher can give him some individual attention than if he's in a class with 41 other kids, okay, and the teacher can't. So I think it would have a positive impact on attendance also.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the impact of charter schools and the privatization of schools. That seems to be a really big issue that not a whole lot of people are actually digging into.
Yeah, I think it's a big issue, and it's an issue in this contract negotiation. Most of the stuff with charters, a lot of it cannot be resolved through this contract. A lot of it is a state issue, but there are things that can be done through the contract. And Austin Buettner, you know, as is his manner, he says, no, this is all the state. We can't negotiate on this at all, et cetera. Okay, he's just trying to ignore the problem. In our contract negotiations, we've talked about the issue of co-location. And what happens is this, you're running a school, and then you've got a certain amount of rooms or parts of a building that you're not using or you're not using fully. A private charter operator could get permission to come in and take over that part of your school and set up their own charter school. And, of course, what they do, whether they want to admit it or not, one way or another, what they do is they take the students they want and they get rid of the students they don't want. For us at LAUSD, to get rid of it, to kick out a troublesome student, it's a big, big issue. For them, they don't want you, you're gone. Mm-hmm. So they choose the students they want, they push out the students they don't want, and they operate their school on our campus, and then they have the gall to pretend that when they get higher test scores than we do, it's because they're doing a better job than we are. I mean, it's incredible. It's incredible that the media has bought this total scam. On top of that, they have smaller class sizes than we do. On top of that, and this is something that came out in the Neutral Fact Finders report in December, on top of that, while the district's crying poverty right and left, they're not even collecting the fees they're supposed to collect from these charter operators who are running schools on LAUSD campuses using our own facilities.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Glenn Sachs. Glenn teaches high school in the teaches high school social studies in the LAUSD, and we're talking about the current strike that's shaping up for, in Los Angeles and how important it is for people to know that what it's about and to know what's going on and to actually stand on the right side of things. I think that's really a call to people from me. That's really a call to people to stand on the right side of things. Now, Glenn, we were talking about this, and I was thinking about with the charter schools and all. People, I don't know how much people know about the charter schools, and what you're saying is very, very revealing and very, you know, it's sort of, it makes you, one, step back, but it also is enraging in a certain extent. Because you think about the nature of the overall student population in LAUSD. You know, a lot of students who, because of their background and conditions of life, need more help, especially, you know, more one-on-one with their teachers. But overall, what's, you know, it seems everything that's going on is the exact opposite of what these students who form the majority of the population, the school student population in LAUSD, what's happening is exactly the opposite of what they need.
Well, that's true. And the whole charter movement, I mean, certainly there are well-meaning people within the charter movement, and certainly there are a lot of well-meaning teachers within the charter movement. But the effect of the charter movement is to create two tiers of schools. One tier that has the students that you want, the best students, and it gets rid of the students who you don't want or can't hack it or are struggling or have special needs or special challenges or whatever, and have smaller class sizes. So they're creating one set of schools sort of for the elite. And, you know, the rest are kind of these rump schools that won't have enough funding, that'll have very high class sizes, and that'll have, for the most part, the students that the charters don't want. And I just think it's appalling. I'm appalled by the whole situation. Our students in LAUSD, they're very capable. They're very bright. They're very capable. They do start off farther behind than the average middle-class American kid because their parents, a lot of them, they only have a 7th, 8th, 9th grade education in Mexico or Guatemala or El Salvador. They can't help their kids the way an educated middle-class American parent can, but they care, they're doing their best, and these kids, they have a lot to offer. They do start off further behind, but they have a lot to offer, and we want the district to invest in them. We want them to have the same education that anybody else has, that people in the better schools have.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's extremely important, and I think about this because when you're talking about this, you know, with students of color and immigrants making up more of the student population, as you're talking about, and that the funding per student has steadily declined, and that figures in. From what I've read, that's been a big part of what a lot of the teachers that are on strike are talking about. And I was thinking about this because the children of oppressed nationalities, in a way, they're being trained for, you alluded to this, they're being trained for menial work and living under the rule of white supremacy, which is, to me, is huge. I mean, because the LAUSD is like the vast majority of students are not white. It really strikes me in terms of when you're looking at what is the impact going to be on these children, as you're talking about, these children of oppressed nationalities being trained for a certain level of menial work or living under the rule of white supremacy?
Well, you know, I'll leave white supremacy to you, but I do definitely think that the fact that our students are 90% minority, that they're 76 or 78% poor, I think it has an impact. I find it very, very hard to believe. Maybe I'm wrong, but I find it very hard to believe that if our schools, if our population were white middle-class kids, I find it very hard to believe they think it's okay for fourth graders to be in a class with 38 other kids or 10th graders to be in a class with 43 other kids or for us to not have nurses in every school or not have librarians or have so many students for each counselor that you don't even know who your counselor is. I find it hard to believe that if these were white middle-class kids, these conditions would be allowed to continue. But, you know, most of our students are minority. Most of them are Latino. A lot of them, either their parent, they have a parent who's undocumented. Sometimes they're undocumented. And I just can't help but feeling somehow they just don't matter as much as the white American kids do. And I also feel like that's one reason why we picked up this battle. A lot of these parents, they don't really have the ability to fight within the political system for what's right the way American middle-class parents do. Some of them don't speak English. A lot of them, they're very struggling. They're really on the margins of society. They don't know the political system. It's hard for them to organize and fight effectively. And it's really fallen to us. It's really fallen to the teachers union to fight to defend these students. And that's what we're doing.
Yeah, I'm very glad you are. I have a couple more questions. One, the random searches that go on. The district conducts tens of thousands of supposedly random searches of students. What's the impact of that on education?
Well, I'm not an expert on that aspect of it. But, you know, there are a lot of students who feel offended by that, or they feel targeted. The way they usually will do it is they'll come in, they'll say, well, just randomly we're picking out five kids, and it's usually four kids they know are never going to cause a problem. Then the one kid that they actually want to search or talk to or whatever. And I do think it's a legitimate issue. I don't consider myself an expert on it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk about this. And you've been alluding to this, but the gutting of the entire social safety network that comes with privatization and charters. It's really troubling, and it has deep meaning, very, very troubling deep meaning in the world if this actually goes on. And if this continues, and if this goes down without a fight, where would things end up? What future do you see for youth if this goes down without a fight?
Well, I think you make a very good point, and that's one of the things. You know, LAUSD keeps telling us, we don't have the money, you have to wait. What exactly are we waiting for? The economy right now is relatively good. The state has a huge surplus. We've had successful teacher strikes in the past year in many other states. And now I have no faith in the politicians, but now we've got a new governor and a new superintendent who at least say that they believe in public education. But if not now, when? I mean, we're supposed to just sign a lousy contract and then run along like good little boys and girls for another 3 years while these conditions don't get any better. They might get worse. We're just drawing a line in the sand. We're saying no more. And, I really respect our president, Alex Caputo Pearl. He's basically, he's taken a firm stand here. And he said, we need to solve these problems. And he said, LAUSD, State of California, this is your problem to solve. We're not just going to go run along and deal with these terrible conditions on our own anymore. This is a problem, and you guys need to solve it.
Mm-hmm. All right, Glenn, is there anything you'd like to leave us with before we sign off?
Well, I just think there's a lot of stuff coming out of the district right now that it's really not all that accurate. Buettner is painting all this on us. They're saying that we're striking unnecessarily. We're provoking a strike. Everybody needs to remember, we've been at the bargaining table for 21 months. And they've offered us almost nothing. We've waited. We've done everything we can. And now is the time. And everybody should know, when we're doing this, this is for your students. This is for your students so we can do a better job for your students. That is what this strike is all about.
And in my mind, it also has a whole hell of a lot to do with what the future actually holds out for everyone in terms of that, in terms of how these students are treated, the things that are going down, what wins out in this situation. It's going to have an impact on society at large. So I stand with
you. I agree with you.
Okay, good. All right, Glenn, hopefully we'll talk to you again as this all rolls through, but thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Glenn Sachs, who's a high school teacher in social studies in the LAUSD, and he was recently recognized by Deputy Superintendent Vivian Exchian for exceptional levels of performance as evidenced by overall final evaluation ratings of exceed standards. That's what he got, exceeding standards, and he's exceeding standards that, once again, standing up against the horror that this attack on students teachers themselves that's been going on in the LA school district. And people should really pay attention to this. And I think actually, when you see what's going on, basically, if you have a heart, if you have a mind, if you have any progressive bone in your body, stand up and don't allow this to go down without your voice standing up against it. All right. Right now, I want people to hear something from Bob Avakian, and it's a clip that sort of speaks to this. It's a clip which is part of Imagine, Education, Science, and Culture in a New Society. That's what it's called, from the Revolution Talk. And it's you can find that Revolution Talk is Revolution, why it's necessary, why it's possible, and what it's all about. So take a listen to this, because I think it says a lot about what we've just been talking about.
Let's talk about education. Just like imagining people wanted to go to work, imagine kids who actually wanted to go to school. Imagine if they weren't degraded and insulted all the time and act and treated as if they couldn't possibly learn anything or have any important ideas. Imagine if the educational system actually told them the truth and helped them to understand about the world and history and nature and society. Imagine if it actually helped them to think critically, to challenge everything. Yes, the teachers, yes, the administration, and yes, even the party and its leaders. What if the educational system drew the kids in, along with the teachers and staff, and said, this is a whole new society, a new world. What are your ideas about how this could all be done better? Imagine if the education combined practical things with theory, so the things they were studying and learning, they would go out into society and talk to people who did those things. Or they invite people in, instead of casting the old people off like useless garbage. Invite the old people in to talk about the horrors of the old society and their experience and what the new society means to them. And have them have an exchange with these kids in the schools. And have the kids learn practical knowledge as well as studying theory and learning science and grappling with philosophy.
All right, that was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and that was part of Imagine, Education, Science, and Culture in a New Society, which is from the Revolution Talk, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And I'll tell you what, if you were just listening to our discussion with Glenn Sachs, and then you hear this, think about this. Think about what it could be, what education could be, what our children could be getting, what difference it could make in the world and in their lives and in the world in general and in the future. Do that. And go, and you can watch this clip on my Facebook page, but also just look up, go to revcom.us, and you can find the Revolution Talk there, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. Couldn't get a more appropriate song, all right? It's Inner City Blues from Marvin Gaye. All right, joining us now is Carl Dix, a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and Carl's here to talk to us about, one, about a very sad thing that happened with the death of Nicholas Hayward on December 31st, and he'll tell you who Nicholas Hayward is and why his life was so important, all right? Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Yeah, definitely, man. So give people a sense of who was Nicholas? Who was Nicholas Hayward Sr.? And why do you say that everyone who wants to end a lot of the suffering that's in society, and especially around police terror against Black and Latino people, have lost a very good friend with his death?
Well, Nicholas Hayward Sr., so the father of Nicholas Hayward Jr., a young man who at the age of 13 was gunned down by a New York City cop in the Gowanus Homes Projects in Brooklyn while he and some of his friends were playing cops and robbers, and he had a toy gun. And the cop confronted him. He said to the cop, "We're only playing," as the cop shot him dead. Now, this toy gun, because some people are like, oh, well, the kid shouldn't have been playing with a toy gun. He shouldn't have been murdered by that police officer. And the toy gun had a bright orange strip at the tip of it. So there was no thing of, well, this was a realistic thing. I thought it was a gun. It was clearly not a gun. The kid got blown away. This happened in 1994. And Nicholas spent the rest of his life fighting for justice for his murdered son, murdered by cops who were sworn to protect and serve, but also along the way becoming somebody who dedicated his life to fighting for justice for all of the victims of police terror and digging into why does this happen again and again and again and what can we do to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes him and his life so important.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's very heavy because when you think about this, I mean, as you're saying, he came into the fight around police repression as a product of, a byproduct of his search for justice in the case of the murder of his son. And this is something that, you know, he fought them, you know, from what I know about him, he fought them, you know, tooth and nail as long as he could. And then when he, And then when they refused to charge the cop walked away free. He didn't, you know, turn around and say, okay, I done all I could do. But he actually stepped out in society and saw that this was a bigger problem than just was what had happened to him, that it was actually magnified a million times over across the country. And he acted on that.
Yeah, see, Nicholas didn't just fight up until they refused to indict the cop. He continued to fight. He collected witness statements and other evidence, presented that to district attorneys over two decades, challenged politicians to take a stand on this, got the story of what happened to his son in the media every chance he got. And when a guy ran for a district attorney in 2014 on a platform of reversing past injustices committed by previous DAs, district attorneys, Nicholas went to that guy with this evidence and demanded that he reopen the case. This was in 2014, 20 years after the murder of his son. And that district attorney reopened the case and then again exonerated the murdering pig. But Nicholas fought all the way down, but along the way, he broadened his approach. He saw that we weren't dealing with a few bad cops or an occasional murder by police. He saw it as a nationwide epidemic, and he was actually one of the first parents of police murder victims to join in the effort to have the first national day of protest to stop police brutality, repression, and the criminalization of a generation on October 22nd, 1996. And his joining in was significant because there were a lot of other activists who were like, well, how can you fight police brutality on a nationwide level? It happens city by city. So it's the local fights that matter. But Nicholas got it that they're doing this all across the country, and we can't treat it as local issues. We have to raise it and push it out in the national consciousness that police are getting away with murder. They're targeting especially Black and Latino people. And this has to stop. And he threw in on that right from the beginning and worked with us all the way down to the end, all the way down to the end of his life on that.
You know, one of the things, I know you were alluding to this, and the fact that he actually did engage in and took part in and played a big role in establishing a national movement against police murder and brutality of Black and brown children, of all children, of everybody. He actually put through his life into establishing not just sort of a lot of separate individual people who were like really hurt and seeking to get justice, but he actually seeing that there was a bigger cause here, that there was a bigger cause of the suffering that people were having, and that there was a bigger cause in terms of what people needed to do. He did actually take this up in a nationwide, and I would say actually he was very important in the establishment of what exists today as it does in terms of a national scene against police murder and brutality.
Yeah, and see, that is real. He went to Oakland when the cop who murdered Oscar Grant was on trial. He was out there rallying with people. He was down in Atlanta. He saw this as, this ain't just a fight for can I get some justice for my kid. This is a fight for justice for all the victims, but also to build the kind of movement and consciousness that can stop this, because we don't want more people. He even said, at one point, we don't want future generations to have to fight the same fights that we're fighting now. We got to build this in a way that we can stop this. So he was digging for answers to this. Why does this happen again and again and again? what is it that we can do about it? How do we stop this? Is it enough to just fight for justice case by case, or do we have to go beyond that? And he really sought that. He tried to get to the root of it. And that search, he found a lot of answers in the work of Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and the work that he did to bring out why these kinds of horrors happen again and again, and what's required to stop them.
Mm-hmm. Carl, I want to get into that in just a minute. I want to let people know that I want to remind people that we're talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, and we're talking about Nicholas Hayward Sr., who recently died, and he was an activist around police brutality, around police murder of black and brown and all people. And he was also, as Carl's beginning to get into, Carl described him as a real radical and a seeker of truth. And that led him in a certain direction. And I wanted to talk about that with a little depth, too. So let's dig into that.
Yeah, because it wasn't enough for him that we build up the biggest fight that we can. And he also had come to see that it's not going to be enough to try to get reforms within the system, to try to get some police accountability established, to get a new district attorney, even though he could see that the old district attorneys were no darn good, but it wasn't enough to just elect a new one and hope that this new district attorney, that he or she would do something about this problem. He wanted to get at why does it happen and what can we do about it. And that did lead him to question, like, well, what about this system? Why does this happen again and again? And as I said, he looked at the work of Bob Avakian, and, I mean, here's a quote from him, because around the time that the book Basics was coming out, the book of quotations and short essays from the writings of Bob Avakian, the Handbook for Revolution, as I call it, we were launching an effort to launch this book, and Nicholas joined the host committee for this, and I asked him, like, okay, well, why don't you tell me, and I'll record it so we could tell other people why you think this book needs to be launched like this. And he said, I remember hearing Bob Avakian talking about revolution and speaking up for poor people, and I love how he speaks the truth about what's going on and backs it up with facts and mixes in a little humor. In today's effed up world, I need what Bob Avakian brings to the situation. The whole world does. And see, that was Nicholas, including the part about humor, because when you're talking with Nicholas, you're talking with him and he's laying some stuff out, and then he'll say something and you're like, did he really mean that? And I'd have to look at him to see that sly smile coming across his face. And I'd have to say, okay, man, you got me again. I'll have to come up with a comeback for that next time.
Man.
But that was Nicholas. And even right down to the end, when he was trying to sign himself out of the hospital, you know, and said, look, come on over, let's talk. Let's talk about what needs to be done. Because he was all the way in this, all the way down. And he was for real.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Carl, we have just in 2 minutes or so. How should people respond to this in your view?
Well, I think, and this is important because he was a key force among some of the parents and other family members of people murdered by the police. And several of them have asked me, like, how are we going to go forward without Nicholas? And look, we're going to have a hole. There's going to be a hole in our hearts, those of us who knew and loved and fought together with Nicholas. But we should go forward with that. We should remember him, send our love to his family. But mainly, we got to take up this fight, especially the fight to stop police terror, because police ain't stopped murdering people and the system ain't stopped letting them get away with that. A fight needs to be built around that and built up even bigger. But it can't just be, we're going to continue to fight this, and 50 years from now, we'll still be fighting it. No, we have to aim for and have an orientation for how do we stop this. And that does bring us to the question of revolution, an actual revolution, one that gets rid of this system. And people need to dig for that. They need to dig for what's the source of this problem and what's the solution. And follow Nicholas's example in that. Look into the work of Bob Avakian. Watch the film. Why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution. grapple with what Avakian has to say in that, listen to the question and answer, those that focus on the question of police terror, but also those that focus on the question of the immigrants, you know, and how to deal with that, how to look at and deal with that situation. Because we got to get to the source of this problem, and we got to solve it. We don't want to be fighting. We don't want the next generation to have to continue this fight, and then the generation after that. We got to learn from Nicholas's approach. We got to figure out how and act to stop this.
All right, Carl. Thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right. Look forward to talking to you again soon. Take care. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix, and Carl's a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and we've been talking about Nicholas Hayward Sr., a person who was a tireless fighter for justice and against injustice, and someone who dedicated his life to actually fighting for justice, and he died on December 31st, okay, and just wanted to bring that to you because I think actually his life holds an example for many of us today in terms of in the kind of world we're living in and what are you going to do? What are you going to do about it, all right? So we're going to move into now just real quickly. I wanted to get into this because I don't want to lose any time on this. All right. We're talking now with, I want to welcome to the show, Michelle Chai from Refuse Fascism Los Angeles. And we're talking about, well, one thing, Refuse Fascism is scheduled to and are going to raise a new banner in the sky at the border. Refuse Fascism is headed back to the U.S.-Mexico border, raising a 25-foot banner to the sky in different languages and holding a 150-foot banner on the ground, which reads, "To the world's migrants and all humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America." Michelle, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you.
Sure. Good to have you back. Okay. Okay. All right. Let's jump into this. Refuse Fascism has put out this call, as I was saying, to come to the border to deliver that message. Let's talk about that. What's behind it? Tell people about that. What are you doing there?
Yeah. So as you said, we're going to bring this banner and we're going to raise it to the sky. And the thinking around this is we're going right to the epicenter of these attacks against immigrants where Trump is, you know, has even shut down, you know, partially shut down the government to insist and to fight for this building of this fascist wall. And he visited the border. And so we're going over there and we're bringing this message. We're going to project this message that in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America and that the Trump-Pence regime must go. And this banner in the sky is going to be in different languages. And the thinking behind that is going up against the ugly bigotry, America first, English only fascist program that the Trump-Pence regime and his supporters are pushing forward, right? And actually, you know, putting forward that there is a real organization that is organizing now for the time when we can launch the kind of sustained mass movement in the streets that is putting forward this demand that we are not going home until the Trump-Pence regime is driven out of power. And so that's what we're going to be bringing to the border.
Mm-hmm. Now, why is this action so important right now?
It's actually very important because, again, as I've mentioned, there's this fight going on, right, around this border wall, and it's being focused around, this is an attack coming from the Trump-Pence regime on immigrants, right? And this is part of a larger fascist program. And I think why it's so, it's coming out in the way of the border is because the demonization of immigrants is at the very core of the fascist program, right? To make America white again. You know, there's this whole, like, back and forth, or, you know, people are saying, oh, well, this is, you know, this wall is ineffective, and it's just, its symbol is not going to work or whatever. But you think about, you know, and I want to recommend this article to people. It's up on the Revolution website, revcom.us, and it's called Trump's Wall is a Fascist Monstrosity and Must Not Go Up. But the border security of the Democrats is also a machinery of heartless persecution, demonization, and deportation. And it makes the point that this is a symbol, right? Or what they're saying, oh, well, it's a symbol, it's not effective, it's whatever. But when you think about what was a symbol in Nazi Germany, these yellow stars that were put on the Jewish people, and what was that a symbol for? It was a symbol of genocide. And that is exactly what this wall is symbolizing. And it has everything to do with ethnic cleansing. And so this is why it's really important that, you know, while the conversations, the discussion out in the world right now is that, you know, on Twitter, there's this hashtag that's trending that's called, where are the pesos, right? And that's to say, well, I thought Mexico was going to pay for the wall, you know? And when people start responding to this wall, you know, to the question of the wall on those terms, you've already lost. Because, you know, we have to be talking about what is in the interest of humanity. And the way that this fascist regime is trying to deal with this is by ethnically cleansing all these people, you know? And nobody's talking about what is in the interest of humanity, and we are talking about what's in the interest of humanity. And we're saying that, you know, nothing short of driving out this fascist regime is gonna stop, you know, this rapidly consolidating fascist program, right? And so, and look, at the same time, there's the Democrats that, you know, right after Trump's primetime speech, they came out and responded, right? But it's all on the wrong terms. And it's actually what they're doing is, like, they're aiming to maintain the support of people who are sickened by this and keeping them and thinking and acting within the bounds of the current system, right? Because that is what they actually represent, both sides. And coming at this as a revolutionary communist, you know, the whole system needs to be overthrown, you know? And this is why it's so important for people to actually understand that we should not be relying on these Democrats. These same Democrats, you know, prepared the ground, you know, for Trump to come in and push forward this anti-immigrant fascist agenda. Look at all the way back to, and this is the what this article that I recommended, or there's another one, actually. It's called Questions and Answers on the Democratic Policy on Immigration, How the Democratic Party Has Persecuted and Deported Millions and Murdered Thousands with the Moral Immigration Policy, right? And this is also an article that's up on revcom.us, and it actually walks through, like, how do the Democrats actually deal with the immigrant question? Well, they deal with it, you know, in a way where it's less, you know, it's not as openly as Trump. But they're the ones, going back to Bill Clinton, building this defense and all this border security and the stoking fear around, like, immigrants. And it's been happening, and the way that it's being, you know, people are seeing this is, well, the only other opposition to Trump is the Democrats. But what are they saying, you know? And even their response to it was, well, we signed a bipartisan bill, you know, funding $1.3 billion to bring in all these enhanced technology to continue to criminalize and to oppress and attack these immigrants that are crossing, you know? And so this is why this is really important, you know, in the middle of all this conversation and in the middle of all this debate, we're coming in there and we're saying, no, we're not going to rely on the Democrats. We need to be relying on ourselves. We need to be looking to the people that hate what's happening, to get out into the streets and to get organized to launch, again, the kind of movement, you know, not just protest as usual where we protest one day and go home, but the kind of protest that stays in the streets day after day and night after night, demanding that this Trump-Pence regime must go because it is in the interest of all of humanity and the planet.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that came up as I was listening to you is this whole point that people need to understand that when you're talking about fascists, this is not a matter of name calling. You know, mm-hmm. that this is actually fascists. Look, fascists are fascists. They don't stop. They have a very reactionary agenda. They have a very reactionary plan. Their whole thing is, you know, basically, I mean, it's what it will mean for the people, basically the people coming into this country, trying to come into this country, trying to get a way to survive, to the people here, to the people around the world. First, you got to think about this. What we've seen some of this before, and you could say it this way. First, they came for the Muslims. Then they came for the immigrants. And if people wait, things are going to get much, much harder to oppose because at each step, they are solidifying and reaching out to and solidifying this reactionary social base that's going to be actually standing up and doing this. And, you know, I've seen reports of some of these fascist groups around, you know, in the South who actually have been looking for ways to get into Tijuana or to other parts around the border to stand up and, mm-hmm. you know, search out and hunt for, you know, some of the immigrants that are trying to get across. And there's a question of both for people to realize what drives people here, but also to look, we better recognize what's going on. And if we wait and don't do something, one day we're going to wake up and find it's actually almost impossible to oppose it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is a regime that is, it's Hitler with nukes, right? Like this is on the level on which this is in. And then it is part of the, how they're able to consolidate and like move forward in their agenda is these, you know, his fascist base, exactly what you're speaking to, and how even in his speech, right, Trump's primetime speech where he, you know, he's like walking through all these, stoking fear basically and criminalizing and like demonizing all these immigrants and rallying up and, you know, emboldening his fascist base to, yeah, you know, go to the border armed to the bone and to play the role of border patrol, but without them having to like do it against or break, you know, whatever, like what the border patrol are supposed to be about, right? They can openly like just shoot, you know, these immigrants, right? And they're doing it as a form of like they're playing the role of what the brown shirts in Nazi Germany played, right? Where they were the ones that were down on the ground rounding up all these Jewish people, right, and sending them to concentration camps, right? And that led to the genocide of Jewish people. And so this is what these fascists down on the ground are playing, right? But I just want to say one thing, right? Like the Refuse Fascism Call to Action, which people can find on refusefascism.org, makes the point, if you are not as outraged and motivated to act today as we were right after the election, we are on our way to accepting a great horror that builds daily. If we adjust to the injustice of this regime, do not ask how the German people could have accepted Nazism in the 1930s. And I think that's like, that's really important for people to really confront, right? Because this, you know, people, we're seeing it, right? Every day that people turn on the news, and we can't just accept that, right? And as important as protests are, people getting out into the streets and calling out this outrage for what it is, It has to go much further than that. It has to go to, again, to be able to launch the kind of sustained movement in the streets to demand that this regime must go. Because as, you know, you pointed out, these people, you know, it's not just the people in the White House and just doing policies. It is them. But then it is them unleashing and emboldening. You know, look at what Trump said in his campaign, right? He openly told his supporters, you know, that he longed for the days when protesters were carried out on stretchers and that anybody who would beat these protesters, he would pay for their legal fines. What does that mean? It means go for it and, you know, and shut these people up and put them back in their place and prepare or basically lay the ground for us to be able to carry out these crimes and for people to be sitting down and allowing and just looking and allowing for this to happen. And we're saying no. You know, we have to, again, rely on each other and, you know, get out of our comfort zones and get out there in the streets and demand that this whole regime is illegitimate and that this whole regime has to be driven from power.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, and it's very heavy. I mean, I was in Tijuana just before the holidays, and, you know, what I saw there was astounding. I mean, one, you see this inflow of masses of humanity, people who put everything on the line to try and get somewhere where they could live, you know, basically be able to stay alive with their family, with whatever. And a lot of people going north so they could get in hopes of getting something to send back to the family. And then you see that the way they were treated. And one of the things that really struck me was to see when you went out to the shoreline and you saw what was going on that part of the border, and you saw the massive amounts of U.S. military with their guns, whatever the guns are that they carry, big rifles that can kill lots of people, you know, mm-hmm. Holding onto these rifles and pointing them over towards the people on the other side of the border who were like extending their hands, trying to touch their loved ones or something. And then as soon as somebody, I saw a woman who was trying to touch a baby on the other side, and as soon as she started to reach out, Immediately, these armed thugs came running in and tried to capture her, and they did eventually capture her, threw her in a wagon and took her away on the other side of the border. And it was really, you look at the massive amounts of barbed wire now that are rolling out along there. You know, this is the kind of thing, and you can't help but think of what you were talking about earlier about, look, this is not sort of some small little thing. This is actually the development of fascism on a grand scale in a way that's going to have a huge, huge impact if people don't stand up and oppose this. So I want to talk to you a little bit more about this. We have a few minutes here now, and I want to talk about what you're doing with this. Just give people a sense of what you're going to be doing at the border, and then we'll talk about also the details, how they can get there, where they should go, who they should look for.
Yeah. Well, look, I just want to speak to, this is the story that you're telling is so heavy, and I actually want your listeners to really think about this, right? Think about this outrage, how heartbreaking it is that, exactly what you're speaking to, these people that are here simply looking for a right to live, okay? And they're being denied that right, and they're being, terrorized through this whole process. And look, and this is, I just have to say, after reading this article, is just, this is coming from, this is going back all the way to, this is the kind of things that these Democrats actually, prepared the ground for, right? Obama, sent all these the military to the border. The militarization of the border even started with Bill Clinton, right? It goes all the way back. This is the way that these people see. They're doing it on the down low, but it's just as vicious and it's just as ugly. And so, again, I would argue this is the reality, and this is why we cannot rely on these people. This is why, as good sounding as people think it sounds when they speak, this is just BS. It's not in the interest of humanity. These are crimes. This is just outrageous to hear what you're describing. But so I want to challenge your audience. If you're outraged, if you felt the same thing that I felt, which I just felt choked up hearing the story that you're telling us, Michael, if you feel this outrage and you don't want it to end and you want to stand with humanity and you actually want to see an end to this, then come to the border with us. Change your plans today. Call everyone you know and tell them to come down here, because nobody's bringing this message to right to where this is happening. Nobody's talking about how we're actually going to put a stop to this. Everything, and as good and as, coming from a really good place as it is, people are just going down there to provide humanitarian aid, which is important. But if we just leave it at that, then we're just going to keep providing the aid to the millions and millions of people that are going to keep fleeing from the country. Because, look, people are fleeing their country, because of the conditions that the U.S. has created by backing coups, by, destroying the environment, by creating the kinds of conditions that make it impossible for people to live there. And they risk their lives and they come to this country for what? To be criminalized, to be demonized, to be murdered in the hands of Border Patrol. So if you hate this and you want to see an end to this, again, I would challenge you, change your plans. Come to the border with us. Call all your friends. Come to our office today. We need volunteers. We need lots of volunteers, not just for this action, but to organize the kind of movement to drive out the Trump-Pence regime. And if you absolutely cannot make it to the border and you can't contribute these next 2 days, then make a donation. Because this, again, has consequences. If we do not go out there with this message and challenge what people are thinking and relying on and looking to, then we're on the road, again, as I read, we're on our way to accepting great horrors. And again, this leads to the kind of catastrophic future that awaits us, with the destruction of the environment, with the destruction of the planet. And so, so we're going to be at the border. People should call us today if you should volunteer, and you should call us today, and you should find out, there's different ways that people can come into this. Let's do this. Let's get out there and let's bring this message, this very urgent message that people need to hear right now while all this is happening. And let's change the terms and let's stop accepting the terms that are being given to us right now about 2020, about, whatever. Look, you cannot vote out fascism, okay? This is going to get worse, and we don't want to wait and see how much worse it can get.
All right, Michelle, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
And thank you, Michael.
I think we've run up right on our time. So I'd love to talk to you again, and I'm sure I will. Maybe after this happens, we can get a report back from you. Okay?
Okay.
All right, great. Thanks a lot. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Michelle Chai from Refuse Fascism about the upcoming action they're having at the border down in San Diego. And right on the borderline, okay, Refuse Fascism. And again, you know, this is not something to sit back on, all right? And I want to thank all of my guests, as I said, Michelle Chai. I want to thank Carl Dix, who joined us to talk about Nicholas Hayward, Nicholas Hayward Sr., and Glenn Sachs, the teacher in the LA Unified School District, who talked with us about the strike that's going on and the need for people to recognize what's going on and why they need to support it. I want to thank all of you for listening today. I want to thank my board op today, Kiana. All right, there you go. And I want to thank Henry Carson for joining us today and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, it's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going to go out now with one of my favorite songs, Let's Make History, from International Noise Conspiracy.